It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how hospital mergers and acquisitions in Wisconsin affect patient care and affect healthcare costs. According to health policy research organization KFF, hospital and health system mergers, they're common. Call in with a question, share your perspectives, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Rachel Werner is a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine and executive director of Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Dr. Werner, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, yesterday we had news in our state of a signed definitive agreement that would merge two nonprofit healthcare systems, St. Luke's in Duluth, Minnesota, and Aspirus in Wausau, Wisconsin, in our state. And so this follows at least four other major hospital mergers, either announced or finalized in Wisconsin over the last year. What are the main factors that are driving hospital consolidations?
Well, healthcare consolidation is certainly not just happening in Wisconsin. It's a trend we're seeing across the entire country, and it's impacting every aspect of healthcare, from hospitals to physician practices. For hospitals, merging has several potential benefits. Hospitals often claim that it allows them to increase the coordination of care across hospitals. It reduces duplication of services within a market. It can actually improve integration and management and also reduce operating costs for a hospital. So hospitals look at mergers as a way to improve their efficiency and potentially increase access to acute care services. And so those are the arguments often that hospitals use when they're looking to merge with other hospitals in their area.
Well, here we have, in this case that I just mentioned, two nonprofits are, and you know, as a combined organization, they would operate, they say, 19 hospitals. Are mergers of two nonprofit health systems beneficial in some respects that wouldn't otherwise be beneficial?
So mergers in general, whether it's a for-profit hospital or not-for-profit hospitals, like the cases that you're citing, have a detrimental effect on prices. They tend to increase the price that insurers pay for care for commercially insured individuals. And they don't really have improvement in quality. And so really what we see is just higher prices, no improvement for patients.
I want to touch down on the word trend. You called this a trend. When did you start seeing the wave? I mean, some people point to the Affordable Care Act. How did this trend begin in mergers and consolidations?
So the trend goes back far before the Affordable Care Act. It's not a new trend or a new challenge. It has rapidly accelerated recently. Going back into the 1990s, there were just under 2,000 hospitals. And then between 1998 and now, we've seen a decline from mergers in the number of hospitals, going from about 8,000 down to just over 6,000 hospitals. So really, 25% decline in the number of hospitals in this country, in part due to mergers. Over time, the number of independent hospitals has declined predominantly because of these mergers. And at the same time, the number of hospitals that are part of a larger system has increased. So most recent numbers that I've seen is that by 2017, about two-thirds of all hospitals were part of a larger system as compared to only half of hospitals in 2005. And so it's a trend that's been going on for quite a while. It's not clear why it's going on. The Affordable Care Act may have accelerated this trend increased hospitals feeling that they need to merge to be able to respond to some of the incentives in the Affordable Care Act. But it's certainly been a long-term trend that we've been watching in healthcare.
We're talking about hospital mergers with Dr. Rachel Werner, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and executive director of Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. You can join in with your question and your comments at 800-642-1234. Dr. Werner, is this consolidation you're seeing affecting urban and rural areas differently?
We're seeing consolidation across both urban and rural areas. What we're seeing in rural areas is slightly different. And so what we've been talking about so far is really what we think of as a within market consolidation, where two hospitals within the same market merge. What we're seeing in urban area in rural areas is something we often refer to as cross-market consolidation, where a hospital from outside of the region that the hospital serves merges with that hospital. And so those cross-market consolidations are equally as concerning as the within market consolidations. The rural situation is particularly interesting because many rural hospitals are closing in the United States. And they're closing at a more rapid rate than urban or other metropolitan hospitals. The mergers that happen for these rural hospitals may actually keep them open. It may prevent closure of those hospitals. But we still worry about the effect that those mergers have on prices and on quality of care.
You mentioned cross-market mergers, and this month a deal fell through involving Unity Point Health and Presbyterian Healthcare Services that would have created a 48-hospital system from Wisconsin to New Mexico. Do out-of-state owners operate differently than systems that are locally owned?
Well, that's one of the worries about cross-market consolidation, is that out-of-state owners may have less concern about community needs, less familiarity with what community needs are, and less incentive to invest in the needs of a community. The effects of those cross-market mergers on things like market power, which is what increases prices, are really quite similar, though, to within-market mergers. And the way that works is that hospitals, when they merge across two markets, it increases the acquired hospital's bargaining position. So those hospitals that are acquired within Wisconsin have a better bargaining position with insurers, and so they can demand higher prices. And so in many ways, cross-market mergers are really very similar to within-market mergers.
How are healthcare workers affected by hospital mergers?
The concern for healthcare workers is that when there are mergers, it may decrease staffing levels within hospitals. Whether or not that's true is really unclear. I think from the hospital's perspective, they perceive some efficiencies in the staffing when they merge, because they can move staff between hospitals depending on the demand within those hospitals. So they're better able, in economic terms, to match the supply of staffing with demand for those staff. The concern among hospital staff, which is justified, is that it may decrease staffing levels overall as merged hospitals seek to create efficiencies and worsen working conditions. And I think the jury is out on that, though it is certainly something to be concerned about.
In general, are those the types of apprehension you feel that are coming out of healthcare unions? I mean, how do healthcare unions feel about mergers?
So I think healthcare unions certainly are keeping an eye on healthcare mergers. I would say that healthcare unions are primarily concerned with working conditions and wages and benefits. And their specific stance on mergers, I don't know, but I imagine that it's something that they are concerned about.
Dr. Rachel Werner is a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, leads the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics as we discuss the consequences of hospital system mergers in Wisconsin and elsewhere. You can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. With hospital mergers and acquisitions underway around Wisconsin, we check in on the healthcare landscape with a University of Pennsylvania physician economist. Dr. Rachel Werner is here exploring the effects of consolidation on medical services. You can join the discussion at any point, calling in with a question. You can share your perspectives, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Werner, you just testified before the Pennsylvania House of Representatives on hospital consolidation, and you told lawmakers that mergers can increase commercial health care prices by up to 50%. Why can mergers increase cost to this degree?
Yeah, so the increase in prices that we see, specifically commercial prices, actually makes a lot of sense. Higher prices are the result of a hospital's increased market power after merging. And with fewer other hospital options in the market, the ability of a merged hospital to use that market power to negotiate higher prices from insurance is a real problem. What happens is that hospitals negotiate with insurers over network and over price, and insurers want to build a network of hospitals that's a good value to their consumers and their customers. So when there are two hospitals that are in the same market and they are perceived to be of equal value, so they provide equally high quality care, similar services, and what we think of as good substitutes for one another, those hospitals, when the insurer goes to try and include them in their network, those hospitals have to compete to be included because one is equally good from the insurer's perspective as the other. The insurer can then bargain on price. And so they can say, you know, we'd like to include you. We're going to include whichever one comes in at a lower price. That obviously results in a lower contracted price with the insurer. But when two hospitals merge, the insurer will want to include the merged hospital in the network if there's no other good substitute options in that market. But once they're merged, they can no longer bargain over price. So there's no alternative to the merged hospitals. This results in higher prices.
And you really, thank you for explaining the marketplace. Just peeling back the curtain a bit, how do you know there is a spike in costs when hospitals may not make their pricing on services easily accessible to patients?
Well, so researchers have studied this in a variety of different ways. There are some data sets that allow researchers to see the prices that are contracted with the insurers. Mm. The inability of consumers to see those prices has been a real problem in healthcare marketplaces, and it's actually a problem that was addressed through a federal law that was passed about 4 years ago, which aimed to improve price transparency in hospitals. And so hospitals and insurers are now required by federal law to release that contracted price to the public. The idea there is that it promotes competition. It allows consumers and also other insurers to more readily observe what those contracted prices are and prevent sort of some of the concerns around price gouging. That law, I think, while well-intentioned, has been hard to implement in a way that is usable to consumers because there's just so much data about prices at hospitals that it's very, very hard to parse out. And so we haven't quite reached a place where that more accessible pricing data has been readily used by the consumer market.
As we examine the players in the marketplace, so to speak, you've warned about the effects of private equity investment in healthcare. How are investors affecting healthcare consolidation?
Right. So private equity is another trend in healthcare that economists and policymakers are actively monitoring. Acquisition of hospitals by private equity firms has soared over the past decade. And this has really sparked a debate about the growing influence of private equity in healthcare. And how it might affect all the same things we're concerned about with consolidation, which include costs, quality, and access. The private equity firms that invest in healthcare and hospitals specifically, the concern around them is that it may increase consolidation. And the way that happens is that private equity firms, at least in the physician market, tend to acquire relatively small physician practices one at a time. And the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, doesn't oversee or monitor those kinds of acquisitions that are less than $100 million. And so while a private equity firm may be acquiring just one small hospital or one small practice, over time within a market, they acquire more and more of those small, they do more and more of those small deals, and it results in market consolidation. At the end of the day, that market consolidation is no different than the market consolidation that we see from hospital mergers that we've been talking about. And this increase in consolidation can lead to higher commercial prices with no positive effects on quality. And it may also decrease access to care for patients.
As you examine the regulatory environment here, the Federal Trade Commission successfully challenged 4 hospital mergers last year and was set to challenge other consolidation attempts. How are state and federal antitrust agencies approaching hospital merger regulation? What do you see?
So the Federal Trade Commission at a federal level is certainly paying more attention to hospital mergers, and this has risen to the top. One of their priority items is to monitor this more closely, as you've noted. There are a number of potential state actions that could limit hospital consolidation, and also once mergers occur, the ill effects of consolidation. So states can serve as another potential check on anti-competitive mergers and can sue federal antitrust law and enforce their own laws. There was a recent review of state antitrust enforcement in healthcare, which identified several practices that states are using to support more robust enforcement of anti-competitive practices. And those include requiring hospitals to provide adequate notice for potential mergers, and also requiring them to have waiting periods, which really just allows states to have longer periods for review and also investigation of what the potential outcomes of those mergers might be. Mm-hmm. States have also established criteria for merger review and the ability to conduct a full analysis of the economic and healthcare implications. I think more action is happening within states in consolidated markets to try and prevent anti-competitive behavior, since there have already been so many mergers that have taken place. It's very hard once hospitals have merged to unwind that merger or to disaggregate those two hospitals. So we're now living in a world in which there is a lot of consolidation among hospitals. And so what states are focusing on is to try and prevent anti-competitive behavior from hospitals and insurers within those markets. And a lot of that has to do with the way monitoring the way insurers are contracting with hospitals and preventing anti-competitive contracting practices. And so those are some of the activities that states are engaging in. You know, I think at the extreme end, the states, because we're mostly most worried about higher prices, some states have opted to try and establish caps on prices and use rate setting to try and limit the increase in prices. So that's sort of the most extreme activities that states are participating in.
Dr. Rachel Werner with us, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, executive director of the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, as we talk about hospital mergers and the ripple effect. You can join in your questions and comments. Welcome, 800-642-1234. Dr. Werner, in March, the American Hospital Association issued a report saying, look, mergers provide scale to reduce healthcare costs and to improve care. Really the opposite of what you've been talking about here. What is your response to the American Hospital Association?
So when we look at the research that's been done out of academic settings, it's really quite consistent that mergers increase prices. And so there should be no doubt about that piece of this. Whether or not it affects quality and access, which is ultimately what the AHA was referring to in that report, is a little bit more open for debate. I think the research that I have reviewed suggests that for quality, there is definitely no improvement in quality once hospitals merge with one another. And there's been some evidence that quality goes down. The effect on access to care is a little bit even more muddy, but generally we find that as hospital markets become more consolidated, there's worse access to care, particularly for people enrolled in Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so while the AHA is citing some efficiencies and sort of economies of scale that hospitals have after they've merged, those efficiencies are not translating to benefit for patients. And in fact, through higher prices, patients are bearing the brunt of that because they pay higher insurance premiums.
In our last moments together, how could state lawmakers address problems or begin to address problems stemming from hospital consolidation?
So I think states should continue to actively monitor mergers and try and require hospitals to be more transparent and have waiting periods around mergers. states should also more actively monitor the contracting practices of insurers to prevent anti-competitive behavior on the part of those contracting practices. Mm-hmm. And then states can also encourage more transparency related to price and quality, which allows consumers to try and choose the hospital that's best suited for their needs. And that really promotes competition. So it tries to counter some of the negative effects of consolidation in the market.
Dr. Werner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Rachel Werner, professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks to a suggestion, Tina in Oshkosh, we learn about strain on vocal cords and other voice disorders. Teachers, actors, salespeople on calls during the day, these are some examples of occupations with more vocal stress. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can add your views at 800-642-1234. Wendy Fabiziak is a speech-language pathologist in Oshkosh, specializing in voice disorders and vocal cord dysfunction. Wendy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So as it becomes more like winter in Wisconsin, temperatures cool, does vocal cord dysfunction become more common? Is there any seasonal connection?
Oh, good question. Anything that can be potentially irritating to the vocal cords can trigger more issues with it. Very extreme cold, dry air certainly can trigger, as well as the humid, hot air itself. So both season extremes do tend to increase some symptoms with this.
So the Cleveland Clinic says stress is also a common cause of vocal cord dysfunction. What are some other causes?
Well, originally we saw vocal cord dysfunction as generating as a result of irritation. So a lot of times that was about internal irritation in terms of perhaps post-nasal drainage, reflux that was coming up from the stomach, creating irritation in the throat. And our body is very good at protecting the vital organs. So those vocal cords would start to close, shutting any potential passage into the lungs, which started to then create some of the symptoms of shortness of breath, coughing, throat clearing, etc. So that irritation, but it isn't just internal irritants, things in the air during the Canadian wildfires, certainly that was irritating, fumes, pollens, things that people may be allergic to, all increase the propensity to develop some issues with this.
Can you step back for a moment and give us like a working knowledge or a tour of this part of our anatomy and how the voice box works?
Oh, absolutely. It really helps. And with my patients, it's a huge component of the therapy because when people understand their own anatomy, it helps. The idea of not being able to catch your breath becomes very terrifying. And unfortunately, it feeds the symptoms because a lot of this can also occur as a result of stress, as you mentioned. So the voice box is situated, the larynx, Adam's apple, all the same thing. We all have one right in the middle of the throat. If we look down that voice box, our vocal cords are situated right in the middle of that. They open and close and are literally the doorway down into the lungs, which is underneath those vocal cords. So when the vocal cords are wide open, there is free air exchange up and down from the lungs, out the mouth and nose when we're breathing. What happens during vocal cord dysfunction is there is a slight closure. And that closure can range from pretty significant to very mild. It can come and go quickly. It can stick with you for hours. But that's basically what's happening, subsequently creating symptoms of difficulty drawing in a deep breath of air, feeling that air that I take in doesn't feel fulfilling, like it's not like it's traveling through too much tension in my throat. It can create coughing, it can create throat clearing, voice issues, all associated with this, occasionally even some swallowing problems.
So what happens if those if there's inflammation in the vocal cords? What, you know, I'm thinking even of laryngitis. What happens then?
Well, and to tell you the truth, now as we're learning more and more about this condition, we know now that this is often set off by something like laryngitis, by an upper respiratory illness, by that kind of thing. And of course, we just went through having a lot of people have COVID, and I am certainly seeing a lot of fallout of that now. Inflammation is not a necessary component of this condition, but certainly when there's a lot of chronic irritation, like nasal drainage, like reflux, it can add another dimension to it. If there is inflammation, that's basically puffing up the vocal cords, swelling them a little bit, which further narrows that airway tract.
Can medications or prescriptions you're on, can that cause problems in the voice box?
It can cause drying. There are a lot of medications that can cause drying. Our voice box likes to be nice and moist. It's mucosal tissue. So drying medications can be an issue. The other issue is, in the past, we always just would hand someone an inhaler, frequently riddled with steroids, and say, try this, use this. The problem was, steroids, inhalers, albuterols, those types of things open the bronchioles down lower in the lungs. But that's not what this condition is. It's not about asthma. That the inhalers will treat asthma, but this is more up at the level of the throat, of our voice box. And we're finding that actually some of those inhalers, most of them, are actually creating even more irritation and certainly not helping, if anything, perhaps even making things a bit worse.
The Mayo Clinic says that vocal cord dysfunction can be misdiagnosed as asthma. How do you tell the difference between vocal cord dysfunction and asthma?
And that's a huge piece of education for my patients, is recognizing. And it is very common for me to treat people that have both these conditions. It's identifying where the symptoms occur. I talk to people about the breathing apparatus, almost just like an upside down tree. The trunk is our throat. The tree branches come out, get lower down into our chest and our lungs. If there's more of a pressure sensation, a tightness, low, a stinging, a burning down lower in the chest, that's often more associated with asthma. But these patients with vocal cord dysfunction are more so feeling a tension up higher at the level of the throat, where it's almost like effortful, muscular. There may be some tension or even tenderness, pain in the throat itself. That should not be occurring in asthma.
We're talking about voice disorders with Wendy Fabiziak, speech language pathologist. You can join in with your questions and your experiences. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, when you look at a cross section of your patients, who is most likely to experience vocal cord dysfunction?
Female, 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 about 80% female. However, other than that, what we do see is a predominance of this in middle school, high school girls. I also see it a lot in people that professions involve a lot of talking, like teachers, where they're trying to get out a lot of words in a short amount of time, not really breathing appropriately. I've also seen this case with people that have gone through some significant stressful events. I had a patient that was raped. I'm dealing more with PTSD, some of the soldiers. So certainly high stress issues that come around can cause this in and of itself also.
Why women and girls?
You know, it's we're questioning it. We're looking at hormones a bit, the research is. However, I do believe there's something about that females tend to seek help more from a medical professional. So the females are coming and going, this just doesn't feel right. Where men tend to wait unless it's really significant. And this is more of a chronic kind of irritation. So I think some men are just dismissive of it.
So a chronic type of irritation, is vocal cord dysfunction something that a person can self-diagnose?
In essence, you know, to get a very specific diagnosis, we have to put a scope, a small laryngoscope, through the nose, down the throat, and observe the vocal cords misbehaving and the symptoms happening. The problem is these symptoms vary very quickly. Like I said, it may persist for hours, but it may only occur for a minute or two. So if we're not looking at the vocal cords at that very moment that it is occurring, it won't actually diagnose it. There was a day where insurance has required that in order to get treatment, but now this is becoming much more just symptom driven. The symptoms are very specific, very specialized to this disorder. So it is something that people almost can, yes.
Do you find, you know, in the procedure of going, you know, up the nose and back down, I mean, is that done without any sedation?
You know, it is. Okay. There is no sedation. However, they often will spray some lidocaine, which is a numbing agent, into the nose. So it's not necessarily painful, but it does feel awkward, a little gaggy. And when you're already feeling like it's hard for you to catch your breath and you're struggling with perhaps breathing and or coughing, throat clearing, it's not a pleasant experience. So like I said, these days we're not doing it as consistently with the scope.
Wendy Fabiziak is a speech-language pathologist in Oshkosh, helping us to understand vocal problems and different therapy approaches that we'll get into. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with the question. You can share comments along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to an email request from Tina in Oshkosh, we learn about vocal cord dysfunction and how it's more common than we might think. Speech-language pathologist Wendy Fabiziak fields your questions about causes, treatments, and exercises that can help to restore the voice. You can join the conversation and ask your question. Call 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wendy, what therapies exist for vocal cord dysfunction? What are options?
Well, it's primarily treated with the assistance of a speech therapist, myself. A big component of the treatment is identifying the symptoms, understanding the symptoms, realizing that although the symptoms can be quite scary, they cannot take your life. Worst case scenario, I've worked with probably 1,000+ people. Less than 5 have actually passed out, but that is the worst case scenario in this condition. Once the body relaxes, then the breathing mechanism works naturally. But getting them into therapy, it's not long haul treatment, usually anywhere from 1 to 5 sessions, but teaching them to not only identify their triggers, I work with them on learning to relax the laryngeal structure, the throat itself, the voice box, letting that relax so that the movement of the air is more free. I teach specific breathing strategies to compensate for what is going on with the vocal cords.
Do you typically need a referral to see a speech language pathologist?
You do. I do need a physician referral. That often comes from the form of ENTs, pulmonologists, allergists, but this condition that we just became aware of in the 80s has finally come into the mainstream, and primary care physicians are also referring to me now, too. In fact, they're very receptive to sending somebody over for therapy. It's a relatively inexpensive treatment that can really help very quickly.
We heard from Juliet in Bayfield called in, and Juliet says their son has breath control issues in speaking and communicating due to trauma as a baby. And Juliet would like to know what exercises or treatment is out there.
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. And it depends on how old he is. Although when it comes to this, I have worked with anywhere from 4 to 94, but really teaching him how to better manage the diaphragm and the appropriate breathing strategies. The problem is we have a lot of emphasis right now on breathing. It's very prominent in the schools with our children, but to get the kids using breathing that is actually an effective breathing technique that can actually help calm the system and allow the airflow to coordinate more effectively with the voicing is an entirely different matter. Being able to truly use the diaphragm correctly, it really doesn't take a lot of work, but it takes educating, practicing, and showing someone truly how that works rather than the idea of just taking a big deep breath, because that in no way is using the diaphragm.
Let's bring on a call. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, what is your question?
I'm a 91-year-old person. I've had a 45-year history of Barrett's throat, and as of late, my voice is very much changed, as you can tell. What does this person know about Barrett's throat, please?
Nancy, thank you. Wendy?
Well, Barrett's esophagus, or Barrett's throat, has to do with irritation of reflux in the esophagus. Oftentimes, if the reflux is making it all the way up into the esophagus, it can go even further up into the throat. Once that reflux hits the throat, it is ripe to then fall down and hit the vocal cords. That reflux, very caustic, acidic, is very damaging to the voice box and to the vocal cords. It also can be causative in both vocal cord dysfunction and voice problems, having difficulties in using the voice. Barrett's esophagus absolutely needs to be treated with medication to get that under control.
Nancy, thank you for the call. Christina in Glenwood now. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm curious to know if the heat from our morning coffee or tea affects the vocal cords. And also, if it does, is there a certain temperature that we should not exceed?
Wendy.
Wow. That's a great question. So here's the reality of it. When we're drinking something like coffee or tea, there literally are two tubes in the back of our throat. The back tube goes all the way down to the stomach. That is your esophagus. That is where your coffee or tea are going to go, down that back tube. There is a tube right in front of that, the trachea. The trachea is where our voice box or our larynx is located. Liquids like coffee and tea do not go into that voice box. That would be aspiration, because then it would be going down into our lungs. That is definitely not good. So I've had singers that are really hyper-focused on what they're swallowing. The reality of it is that it isn't touching the vocal cords. But in general, heat is good for muscle relaxation. Stress causes tension, particularly to muscles about the throat and the larynx. So although drinking hot beverages don't necessarily do a whole lot, what I've found to be very effective with my patients is using like a hot pad, a rice bag that you can heat up, and putting that literally around some of the muscles around the front of the throat to penetrate more effectively into the voice box.
Talking about voice disorders with Wendy Fabiziak, speech-language pathologist, fielding your questions at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Okay, Wendy, do you recommend throat lozenges to help treat symptoms of vocal tiredness? What do you say about throat lozenges?
Well, here's what I have to say. Absolutely, helping with secretions is good. However, most throat lozenges are riddled with menthol, mints, all of which are very drying and can also frequently stir up that reflux, that acid in the stomach, pretty significantly. So they are not particularly recommended. Rather, I suggest something like a sugar-free, fruit breeze, that type of thing. Because again, having something to suck on can be effective. Most effective is simply having some water. I have some right here with me. When this is happening to people, swallowing can really be just an effective little strategy just to gain some control. So swallowing water is the best thing we can do for ourselves.
Any insights on honey? Does honey help at all?
You know, honey has wonderful healing properties, but again, that honey is going down the back in the esophagus, and it is not actually getting into the voice box or the larynx. So I have no problems with honey. I think it's great, just not super effective in terms of actually, quote, coating the vocal cords, which I hear people say sometimes it does not do that.
Psychologically, we feel like it's
exactly
working.
It feels good.
Some yoga styles and mental health therapies use breathing exercises as part of their practice. Could these breathing exercises help with vocal cord dysfunction?
Absolutely, if done correctly. And it's always curious to me when people say, well, I do yoga a lot and they encourage diaphragm breathing. And I'll say, great, show me your diaphragm breathing. And most of the time, people's assumption of that is simply taking a deep breath in. But it also involves literally using this large muscle right under our rib cage, the diaphragm, effectively. There should be no movement of the chest, shoulders, accessory muscles up in that chest act to only clench and tighten the muscles of the voice box. So the diaphragm, on the other hand, has a nerve that literally runs from it, wraps around and goes up to that voice box. When fully effectively engaging the diaphragm, it communicates to the voice box and says, relax, open, we're breathing now.
Do patients ever need surgery to treat vocal cord dysfunction?
Not typically, no. This is not something that we can modify the vocal folds for. We only do that in cases of like paralysis of a vocal cord. So no, this is something that's treated more behaviorally. And again, recognizing what this is, that it feels like I can't catch a breath, often induces a bit of panicking, which makes the whole thing worse. But when they understand fully what it is, it really helps kind of backpedal, and get into the breathing modality that they're supposed to be using.
In our last 15 seconds or so, you said water is next to you. What other thing would really help us protect our vocal cords?
Avoiding loud screaming in the back of our throat that, go, at Packer games or what have you. the way we use our voice, we can be loud, but we can't be loud and really put a lot of emphasis on that throat itself. Too much caffeine is not great for the voice. Too much alcohol is not great for the voice because, again, those things tend to lead to reflux, which, again, can be quite damaging. Overusing, abusing the voice, again, if you know how to do it, it's okay.
Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Wendy Fabiziak, speech-language pathologist. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.